Well, I'd like to begin today's sermon by asking a question. How would you handle yourself if you were told that you could no longer keep the beliefs that you hold? Imagine you're told that you'll be sent to a labor camp or killed if you continue to state that you believe what is written in the Bible. How would you handle that? Now, we all know the story of Daniel and how he handled being told that for 30 days he was not to kneel before anyone, or with the sound of the, or actually at the sound that was heard, that he was to kneel and bow before the king, and that he would not then be able to pray to God three times a day. And of course, he continued to do what he always did. He disregarded what he was told. He continued praying to God. He didn't bow to any other, and in spite of knowing the penalty of what he was being thrown into a den of hungry lions, that didn't faze him, or at least according to what we read in the story of Daniel, he did what he knew he needed to do before God. Today, the news stories that we are reading and hearing are reaching a level of corruption that I don't believe I've seen in my lifetime. Now, there's nothing new under the sun. When I say that, please understand, I recognize that human nature has been human nature from the get-go. And so, as the Bible shares, or as we know, there is nothing new under the sun. On the other hand, the level of the consistency of the direction of not only our nation, but this world in general, should be very painfully obvious to all of us that it is not what it once was, and that we are trending rather rapidly in a negative direction. For the first time in Supreme Court history, someone leaked a justice's opinion on Roe versus Wade before the final judgment was scheduled to be shared in the coming weeks. It clearly was done in an effort to put pressure on the justices as well as energize a particular political base. Currently, we have a sitting Homeland Security Secretary that is telling everybody with a straight face that we do not have a border crisis or an open border, all the while thousands of people are coming across our southern border each week. If you had land or property there, I think you would see it a little differently than this gentleman does. Currently, we have government officials and powerful teacher unions stating that parents should not be fighting against the education system because elementary-aged school children should be able to know all about sex so they can choose what sex that they want to be. I'll share three more headlines from just this week. Mayorkas denies knowing his disinformation czar called Hunter Biden's laptop Russian disinformation. And states' schools will be required to put feminine hygiene products in boys' bathrooms. And White House to support protests at Supreme Court justices' homes. And finally, I'm not even bringing up the fact that the president of Russia is doing all he can to wipe off the country, or wipe an entire free country off the face of the map. That's just now. It'd be fair to say that we are living in and surrounded by a world gone mad. This world hates God, just as God hates sin. So back to my original question. How would you handle yourself if you were told you could no longer keep the beliefs that you hold, otherwise risk imprisonment or death? Being that it's Mother's Day weekend, I'd like to go back and take a look at an example of a woman who turned to God for help. It's not that she's known for being a mother as much as a queen, and I'm speaking about Esther. Esther faced a most difficult set of circumstances, and she chose not to bow down, but rather to stand strong, not to back down. As we will take a look at her story today, consider what we see in the world around us and compare how she handled what she faced with how today's world and today's leaders handle circumstances or issues that they face. There are important lessons that we can draw from her life that most of this world, frankly, cannot appreciate. And the reason they can't appreciate it is because most of mankind is enamored with sin rather than enamored with the truth of God. It's hard to wrap my mind around how much, or around much, frankly, of what I read today in the news. I have come to see, as many of you have, that the mind of man is simply sick and in need of healing. Satan, as the father of lies, has taken hold of this world and made it his. His stories that Hollywood comes up with, or the stories that Hollywood comes up with, in the form of futuristic films, is so often what we actually see playing out today. I'm sure if time were allowed to proceed, we would probably see the Hunger Games unfold in real life. History tells of some incredible stories. The saying, truth is stranger than fiction, has proven true quite often. The need for the return of Jesus Christ is greater than ever. You know, as one reads through the pages of the Bible and the stories are told of miracles, of controversies, of intrigue, and of peace, history lessons are given and future events are depicted. All in here. Today, in books or at the movies, people are interested in power, murder, lust, revenge, and often they still want and expect a happy, peaceful ending within 2 hours, if it's a movie. There's a fascination with stories that tell of emotional outbursts with vanity and greed. There is an obsession over the afterlife, vampires, ghosts, horror films, and every kind of demented thought imaginable. Why? Because the God of this world, the prince of the power of the air, Satan the devil, has convinced most all human beings that God's word is antiquated, it is restricting, and it actually holds us back from true freedom. The story of Esther and her cousin that serves as her father, who is named Mordecai, is one in which we can compare and contrast to what we see today. It is a story in which I believe the mothers in here can draw from, not because she was, again, known for being a mother. In fact, she was known for being a queen. But it's a story of a strong woman. And I don't care whether you're mother or not. I think the idea appeals to most women to be a strong woman in the right way before God. I believe in order to be a good mother, you must first be a strong woman spiritually. It is a story in which I hope both men and women in God's church can draw true appreciation. It's like so many other stories in the Bible. There are powerful lessons in there for us to learn. Esther's story is a story about the attempted genocide of the Jews. A decree ordered the extermination of young and old, men, women, and children. The place, Persia. The time, 5th century BC. The book of Esther describes how this crisis was averted through her bravery, through the wisdom of her stepfather and the help of God Almighty. Before we get into the book, I will give you a little background. I don't know that you'll necessarily be able to write this down as quickly as I'm going to share it with you, but you at least want to share with you background or history of this particular time that we're about to read about in the book of Esther. Esther, it's important to know, first of all, to understand that the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther form the closing section of Old Testament history. Those three books form the closing of Old Testament history. They tell the story of the Jews' return from Babylon, the rebuilding of the temple and of Jerusalem, and the reestablishment of the Jews' national life in their homeland. They cover a period of about 100 years, 536 to 432 BC. In fact, the last three of the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, lived and gave their instruction and prophecies in this era of the Jews' restoration. The timeline is pretty well understood to be 536 to 516. And it was a 20-year period in which under Zerubbabel, the governor, and Joshua, the priest, the temple was built in Ezra, as it says, Ezra 3 through 6 talks about it. And to this period belonged Haggai and Zechariah. Then skipping to 457 to 432 was a period of 25 years in which under Nehemiah, the governor, and then Ezra, the priest, the wall was rebuilt and Jerusalem was restored as a fortified city. To this period belonged Malachi. But in between these two periods of time tells the story of Esther, who would become queen in 478 BC. You know, it's very evident as you go through this and many other stories told in the Bible that God does and will continue to take care of those who honor Him and who make wise decisions as a result of honoring Him. Now, I know all of us are aware of the promise made to Abraham concerning his descendants, and we recognize this to be true all the way up through today until the return of Jesus Christ. Yet, there have been times in history that in order for God to fulfill that promise, He had to take a very hands-on approach, or Satan would have thwarted His plans. We're reminded of this in the story of Esther. Let's start by turning over to Esther chapter 1. If you're looking for that, it's right before the book of Job. And let's pick up in verse 1. We're going to read quite a bit through this book today. Esther 1, verse 1. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. And in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. So first off, what we see here is Ahasuerus, whose, by the way, his Greek name was Xerxes. He was the son and successor of Darius the First, or Darius the First, at the beginning of whose reign the restoration of the Jerusalem temple took place. The capital city of the Persian Empire was called Susa. That's what we just read there in the first part. That was the capital, as your margin probably informs you. And in Susa was where the story of Esther took place, as this is where the citadel or fortified palace of Ahasuerus was. Now, I think it's interesting to note that the policy of the Assyrian and Babylonian kings was to deport or take away any conquered peoples from their own land and scatter them into other lands. I suppose we could say that this is not unlike what the white man did to the Indians in this country, or the Nazis did to the Jews. On the other hand, the policy of the Persian kings was just the opposite. The Persian kings would send them back to their own land, any conquered people, which was much more humane. For example, one of the first acts of the first Persian king, Cyrus, was to authorize the return of the Jews to their own land. Now, I find this interesting because of what took place in the story of Esther. Genocide would have been much easier, wouldn't it, if all those that were to be killed were found primarily in one spot or one location. And yet, this also shows and reminds us even that much more of the powerful hand of God. No matter what the odds, no matter what the situation, God can and will take care of His faithful people, no matter how few, no matter how together, or how scattered. And in light of what we have all seen the last 25 years plus, in this country, and yes, even in the church, I take great comfort in knowing that. Verse 3 then tells of a feast that Ahasuerus hosts for all the leaders throughout the 127 provinces that were included in the Persian Empire. Now let's pick up verse 4. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. So the Persian Empire was so expansive and Ahasuerus was so vain and so proud of what he had that it took 180 days to party with all of his officials. He probably told the same story over to each group of leaders with boasting and exaggerations over time. You know, like the fishermen, when we started with the fish this size, by the 180th telling the fish was this large. Verse 5. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So at the end of this 180 days, he then gave a final 7-day feast for all those who lived and worked in the palace. Verse 6. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars. And the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement, alabaster turquoise and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other. Wow. With royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king, in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So we see here just how much Ahasuerus had and how much he obviously gloated about what he had. It is pointed out that each person had a cup that was different set that nobody had the same. He apparently was most happy to brag about and point out the abundance that he had. Then notice in verse 9 the name of his wife and the fact that she too was throwing a feast for her own, of her own, for the women of the palace. Today, kind of interesting, you read this verse, we had the ladies all sitting in one area. And we had the men largely with kids over another area. So verse 9, Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Now, the culture at that time was one in which men and women did not feast together. It was not appropriate for women to do so. Verse 10, on the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagatha, Zethar, and Carcass, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her off, basically, show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. So Ahasuerus, still in this vein of showing off what he wanted, wanted to do the same with his wife Vashti. He wanted to parade her, apparently, as much as he did any other of his belongings. But for whatever reason, Vashti chose not to come. Verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs, and therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. The king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew the law and justice, those closest to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Mers, Mersina, and Memucan, the 7 princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to the law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus, who brought her by the eunuchs? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report. King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. And this very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. Really does seem like some sort of movie, doesn't it? Doesn't seem like anything that we could relate to in today's modern age and world. Imagine how women, and for that matter most men, would react to this type of behavior. Obviously, at the time as seen in this example, men were a higher class citizen than women. So Ahasuerus listens to one of his top officials, likes what he hears, and makes a decree, so Vashti is removed. The feeling is that this will stem any tide of uprising that other women might consider. Chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. So here we see apparently Ahasuerus was thinking about Vashti and must have been rather blue about what had happened. And those around him recognized this, so they suggested to Ahasuerus that he take his time and choose from all the most beautiful young women throughout Persia to come before him, and he could name a new queen. Then in verse 5, we are introduced to one of the main characters in the story of Esther. And this man's name was Mordecai, who was her cousin and adopted father. Verse 5, in Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So we are told here that Mordecai raised Esther, who coincidentally was a beautiful young girl, and becoming as time progressed, a beautiful woman. So beautiful that when the decree had been made by Ahasuerus, Esther was taken to the king's palace along with all the other beautiful women. But notice how Esther is taken care of once within the palace walls. And by the way, we too are taken care of by God when we stand for the truth. We are given special treatment by God, and we're given peace of mind. And we are many times given added physical blessings as well. Verse 8 in chapter 2. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther was also taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. So Esther was given special favor that the other women were not. Now, perhaps we could stop here for a moment and address a thought or two. It is not clear as to whether or not Esther was very happy about what was taking place in the palace, or whether she just did it strictly out of respect to Mordecai, which I would tend to think the latter. But that aside, it is clear that for whatever reason, God gave her a special blessing. Now, I can't help but wonder, however, if the reasoning behind this is not cleared up a bit in verse 10. Let's read that. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. Okay, now this is interesting. Esther obviously respected and was loyal to Mordecai. Mordecai said, I want you to do this. She did that. In this case, as it says here in verse 10, don't reveal your people or family. Brethren, I hope we all know what a beautiful, rewarding, and godly trait it really is to show loyalty. Loyalty to God, first. Loyalty to our family, physical family, and our spiritual family. This points out the first lesson that I like to stress that we can learn from Esther's story. God blesses us and protects us when we show Him through our actions that we understand loyalty and that we respect Him and to those who are our caregivers and parents, when we express loyalty and respect to them. Hopefully we think of this often. You know, we certainly are not living in a society that teaches this concept. God does expect us to honor and respect Him. He also expects us to show loyalty and respect to each other so long as all parties yield themselves to God and His truth. Loyalty is surely one of the healthier fruit-bearing attributes found in a man or woman of God. Perhaps we could use another term for loyalty that we hear often today, but rarely see, and that is that of commitment. Esther was loyal. She was committed. She, as we will see, not only here, but in the coming passages, to Mordecai, to her people, and ostensibly to God. Are you loyal? Are you committed to our loving eternal Father and to His church? You know, there are many women who are not committed to their husbands, and as a result, that ultimately leads to affairs or leads to divorce or both. There are also plenty of men that are not loyal to their wives. And of course, that's going to lead to destruction as well. God holds wives, with rare exception, to respect their husband. We see that in Ephesians. We see that in several places. You go to 1 Corinthians as well. But He holds wives, with rare exception, to respect their husband. Now, I say with rare exception, meaning if the husband is being dishonest and straying within the relationship, or the marriage vows were made under what is later found to be fraud, well, those would be exceptions. But again, do you as a wife respect your husband? Now, that's an important part of a strong marriage. Just as the man is to give his life in sacrifice for his wife, as Christ gave His for the church, the wife is to respect her husband. Now, there are very specific jobs that each of us has. That is what the Bible teaches. In this case, we see Esther respecting her uncle, her stepfather, Mordecai, and as the story shows, God blesses her for that. From verses 11 through 14, you can read about all of what the various young women went through before being presented to the king, after which the ladies were placed in another area and kept as concubines. But notice verse 15 that God rewarded Esther with special blessing. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing. But when Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head, made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. She clearly found special favor in Haggai's sight, as well as in the sight of Ahasuerus, and so she became the queen. Now, at this point, the story takes a turn. We read about a plot to take the life of Ahasuerus. Excuse me just a moment. It's muggy in this room, isn't it? And it's still not even a hot day out. Well, let's see where this turns in chapter 2 and verse 20. Now, Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat with the king's gate, within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers. It almost seems like a proper name for a doorkeeper. Bigthan. Became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So these two were not happy with the king. Verse 22 says, so the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So here we see that because of Mordecai, Ahasuerus' life was saved. At least this scheming plan that they had to take his life was taken care of and removed. And the two men who conspired, to kill him were hanged. Yet even after this, Mordecai was not recognized by the king or rewarded for this information. Typically, there would have been a reward, a significant reward for this. Rather, the story continues, and we meet Haman, an Amalekite. Now, if we were watching a movie, the music would change in this scene as we start to talk about the bad guy. Haman became the favorite of Ahasuerus, and as we will see, was given great authority to all too carelessly, or he was given too much carelessly by Ahasuerus. Chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Does this remind you of the story of Daniel at all? Very similar, isn't it? And then when it comes to this place, or this regard to this. Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage, Haman was filled with wrath. Once again, you see very quickly human nature coming out. I want what I think I deserve. I want to be noticed. I am to be noticed. I am to be treated this way or that way. Verse 6, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai, and instead Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, not just Mordecai. All right, he's going to be this way. I'm going to take them all out. Who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. So here we have an obvious case of vanity leading to anger and now a desire to murder. And this is the second point that I wish to bring out from this story. Look at the fruit produced from vanity. Look at the fallout that comes from vanity. Haman's ego was such that he not only wanted to get back at Mordecai, he wanted to wipe out all the Jews. You ever notice how if you have practical jokers, oftentimes if a practical joke is played on somebody, then what do they want to do? Oh, they want to ratchet up big time on the next practical joke, which then leads to the, oh, well, then that guy, and pretty soon, where are you with this, right? It's completely out of control. Well, I think about something like that when Haman, right out of the chute, he's like, okay, that's how he feels. I'll just wipe out everybody that he loves. Take them all out. So in order to do this, he decided to do so under the guise that these people were threats to Ahasuerus, and he pointed this out to the king. He even went as far as to offer money to the king if the king would issue a decree to wipe out these Jews. So apparently Haman was a man of means, obviously, as well. It's not as though the king didn't have a lot, but this is the thing about greed and power. There's no such thing as too much. Only thing is, Haman didn't refer to any specific tribe or group, but merely those who do not keep the king's laws. So he was sneaky about it. Ahasuerus, being the kind of guy he was, thought, well, that sounded very good. He would have that many more riches. So he agreed to the deal, and Haman then sent out a decree, as though from the king, to all 127 provinces, stating that all Jews, including women and children, were to be wiped out, annihilated, and wiped from the face of the earth. And this was to be done at the time decided by casting of lots. As it turned out, the lot fell on the 12th month. Okay, so this was later on in the year. So Haman had to wait a while, but he was willing to do so. Well, Mordecai got word of this, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry, according to verse 1 of chapter 4. And then in verse 3, we can read that as the decree arrived throughout the 127 provinces, there was great mourning among the Jews. Obviously, Ahasuerus did not realize that he was being taken advantage of and was oblivious to what was being sent out by Haman. Again, look at the fruit of vanity, or the fallout of vanity. The fallout of vanity of those people today who choose to ignore what God says and do what they want to do according to their own will ultimately leads to destruction. And that is what we are seeing in our news stories today. That is what is forecast to happen to this nation. In fact, someday we will be under captivity. That's what the prophets of old share with us. You can go to Jeremiah 30 and see that right away. When you ignore what God says and you put your own ideas ahead of what God says, it always leads to devastation on all fronts. Esther enters the picture once again. Let's now pick up the story in chapter 4 and verse 5. Esther called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in the front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. So now Esther has been told and seen with her own eyes the written decree that has caused such an uproar and caused many to fast. But as we are about to see, she felt caught in that she wasn't sure that she could, and certainly she did not know, how to bring it up to Ahasuerus. Verse 10. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called by the king, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. In other words, you're really taking a chance if you go in before the king if he doesn't call you. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. What was Mordecai's response? Verse 13. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than any other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" So Mordecai reminds Esther that even though she is the queen and within the palace walls, she will not be able to escape with her life if this decree is fulfilled. Then comes the next lesson that I would like to consider from the story of Esther. She showed wisdom. She asked Mordecai for advice. That's wise. And she followed the advice. That's wise. I firmly believe that all mothers in the church who prove themselves to be dedicated to the Word of God seek advice from God. And those who live this way, and then they end up showing significant wisdom. All you young mothers here that we have here, and I know we have some that aren't here today, we do have some that are here today, would be wise to learn from what we're reading right here in the story of Esther. Go and talk not only to God and ask for guidance and direction and help, but go and talk to mothers who have been down this road before you. What worked for them? What didn't? What would you do in this case? Now, in order for you to feel comfortable doing that, that means you have to establish relationships with people. That's what I'm asking you to do. It's an important lesson that's being shared here. Notice verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me." Okay, so she had heard what Mordecai said. Now she's sending back to Mordecai. All right, this is what I'm asking you to do. Because if I'm going to go in before the king, I want to know that we got God on my side. "Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. Notice the kind of relationship that they clearly had. They responded to each other very well, didn't they? Esther wanted God's guidance, his direction, his protection. When we are in time of trouble, when we are in time of difficulty, do we take time to stop? To make a wise decision? To perhaps fast, and certainly to pray and ask God for his direction and his help. Esther showed wisdom by first going to God before she did anything else. Okay, now I'm asking you to go and ask the people to pray and fast. She asked that the Jews do the same. This is a wonderful and powerful example for all of us. Any strong Christian woman draws a strong lesson from this right here. Esther showed wisdom by first going to God before she did anything else. She asked that the Jews do the same. What a wonderful and powerful lesson. I sure wish the leadership of this nation thought like this. Don't you? Hold your place here in Esther. We're going to come back, and let's turn over to Colossians chapter 4. Colossians 4. In Colossians 4, let's begin in verse 2. Now think about the words as we read them here. Continue earnestly in, this is instruction that's being given by the Apostle Paul to the church in Colossae here. Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving, and meanwhile pray also for us that God would open to us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in chains, that I may make it manifest as I ought to speak. Okay? Continue earnestly and steadfast in prayer for yourself and also for us. In other words, we're going back and forth and we're praying for each other. Walk in the wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace. A classy woman speaks with her speech seasoned with grace. You know, I don't like hearing anyone, male or female, just use horrible language. It's just, frankly, it's repulsive to me, and I think it is to anyone who wants to live the right way. But a bent instant turnoff of a woman is a woman who has a mouth that is filthy. I can't help but think about, let your speech always be seasoned with grace. A woman in God's church, a mother, is very careful how they speak. That you may know how you ought to answer each one. Paul describes many aspects of what a Christian is to be practicing, but it takes a wise person to ponder and then practice these attributes. It takes a wise person to go to God first so that our actions are premeditated rather than reactive. Esther was wise in taking her concerns and her situation to God first. If our nation's leadership took their concerns to God first and followed what he said, imagine how different this world or country that we live in would be. You and I, as true Christians, definitely should appreciate what this is telling us and why this is important. Following closely on the heels of wisdom shown by Esther, then came courage. As we see in the last sentence of verse 16 in chapter 4, we'll turn back there in just a moment. Not quite yet. And we also see that courage shown in chapter 5. I believe we would all agree that it would take a lot of courage to do something, knowing that you might lose your life over it. Thus, the reason I posed the question at the beginning of this sermon today. Do you have the courage to listen to, follow, obey God's word? Do you have the courage that Esther had? Before we go back to Esther, let's take a look at Matthew chapter 7. Matthew 7. Matthew 7 and beginning in verse 13. Now here we're reading the words of Jesus Christ. We're in the Sermon on the Mount. Enter by the narrow gate. This is a passage we've read many times over the years. For wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. Let's be clear about something. It takes courage to answer the call and to truly dedicate your life to walking the narrow, more difficult path. You're not going to do that apart from courage. A way of life that is beautiful and exciting, trying, but rewarding. Every time I read this passage, I find myself thinking about how many people try to deter us by saying something like, you know, all these people can't be wrong. You think you've got it all figured out. All these people can't be wrong. Or, are you still trying to earn salvation? What's wrong with you? Or, Do you really think God made things to be this hard? Come on. The truth is that Satan loves to discourage. But of course, when we focus on who God is and what he can do for us, just as Esther did in her example, a difficult path doesn't matter. Let's go back to Esther. Pick the story up in Esther 5. What's it take, by the way, to get to that point where it doesn't matter? So the path's more difficult. I don't care. It's the right path. Takes help from God, God's Holy Spirit. We have to respond to that. Has to be something ingrained in us to the point that we say, hey, I don't care what anybody else says or thinks. I know what God said, and that's what I'm going to do. Esther 5, beginning of verse 1. Now, it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes, stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat in his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was. Now, keep in mind, she knew that unless the king was in a good mood and wanted to reach out his golden scepter, that by the mere fact that she would walk into this palace area because without him having asked her in, that she's literally putting her life on the line. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther, verse 2, standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. Now let me stop right here. Do you think that prayer and fasting helped at all? I think we'd all feel quite comfortable and confident in saying, I think absolutely it played a significant role here. She found favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. So here we see the protection and the blessings that God worked out for Esther. And he also works out for us when we do things the right way. If more mothers focused on the responsibilities God has given them as mothers, as opposed to pursuing selfish objectives, imagine how different this world would be. If our leadership wanted to follow the word of God, rather than find ways to befriend wealthy socialites who will give them money for their campaigns, what a different world this would be. Esther was given favor by the king, or we could say he gave her his ear, and it was all because she turned to God. And she had courage to do so. She was faithful to him. She put her trust in him. The king proceeds to tell Esther that whatever her request is, he will grant her that request up to half of his kingdom. Verse 4. So Esther answered, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for them. The king said, bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half of the kingdom, it shall be done. Then Esther answered and said, my petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet, which I prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. Now, the king was probably quite puzzled by Esther's request. But it would seem he was also, I would imagine, he was probably quite intrigued, too. This is kind of like a, not a game of escape room, but there's some inquisitiveness here. Right? She's kind of, I don't know where this is going. This is interesting. After all, it's apparent that he enjoyed being catered to. And I would imagine that he saw this as some little game which was being catered to, so it seemed exciting to him. Well, so was the case with Haman. He really thought, after all, he was in tight with the king and queen. So, and after all, Mordecai and the Jews were about to be removed, and he was the only one invited along with his king to this special banquet by Queen Esther. Wow. I mean, what more could possibly happen to one man? I'm doing great, Haman thought. He was on top of the world. Chapter 5, verse 9. So Haman went out that day joyful, with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, And he did not stand or tremble before him. Oh, he's filled with indignation against that Mordecai. You read the story and you can't help but think, this is so clear about human nature too. Oh, I'm this and then that. You see that person over there? Just flip how he felt. Just that quickly. Verse 10. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself, went home, he sent and called for his friends and his wife Jeresh. And Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Look at all these things I've been given, me. Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared, and tomorrow I'm again invited by her along with the king. I must be something. Once again, we see the arrogance, the vanity, showing off of what he wanted to do concerning all that he had. The fruit of vanity or the fallout is truly quite ugly. This is the same thing I see in those who continually choose to disobey God. Their vanity is ugly. It's hurtful to God. What God sees in this nation must sicken him terribly. Verse 13. Yet all that avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. So he goes through all this that he's excited and happy about. And he flips back over to, I tell you what, I just can't wait to get rid of that guy. Verse 14. And his wife Jeresh and all his friends said to him, well, let a gallows be made, 50 cubits high. She probably got tired of hearing about Mordecai. Here, just go out and build this gallows here, okay? So then you suggest that King Mordecai be hanged on it, or to the king, that Mordecai be hanged on it, and then go merrily with the king to the banquet. Oh, that pleased Haman. So he had the gallows made. Haman had a lot of hatred inside him towards Mordecai. Well, as this was taking place, that very night the king had trouble sleeping. Once again, God chooses to intervene on behalf of Mordecai, who had been loyal, showed wisdom himself, and as well as courage and patience. So surely one of the more exciting principles given to us time after time as we read through these stories is how enlightening it is to see faithful people delivered by the hand of God. Now, I find these stories invigorating to me personally, and I always end up asking myself, could this be me? Am I willing to put God first? Am I really willing to put it all on the line for Him? Now, in my mind, yes. But you get in the heat of battle, would you? Now, there are a number of people in here that have been a part of God's church for many, many years. And you've been through some battles. And you have some battle scars, but you came through it. Others have not. And I would be willing to bet that a sizable percentage of those who have not weathered those storms thought to themselves one time or another, I could do this. And they would read a story like this and say, I'm willing to do that. But something happened. Well, again, Mordecai was about to be rewarded by God through Ahasuerus. Chapter 6, verse 1. That night the king could not sleep, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers, who had sought to lay hands on the king of Ahasuerus. So they see they logged all this down. And remember when we said before there was no reward at the time? Now he's reading about this. Oh, yeah, let's see here. The king said, verse 3, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And how do we reward Mordecai? Because I forgot about that. And the king's servants who attended him said, well, nothing's been done for him. So the king said, who is in the court? Now, Haman had just entered courts of the palace to suggest the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, well, Haman's there standing in the court. So the king said, well, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, well, what shall be done with the man whom the king delights to honor? Well, Haman thought in his heart, well, who would the king delight to honor more than me? Well, now that you mention, I'd like this, this, and this is probably what was running through his mind. To the king, this was an innocent enough question, and one that he was looking forward to having answered so that he could reward Mordecai. But, of course, Haman didn't know that. Haman was certain that Ahasuerus was talking about him. Once again, his vanity and pride stood out. And Haman goes on in verses 7 through 9 to explain, probably in rather glowing terms, what reward should be bestowed upon this wonderful person the king described. Verse 7, Haman answered the king, "Well, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let's see. How about a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden?" Of course, while he's telling this, he's probably thinking to himself, "Boy, I'd look good in these." "Which is a royal crest placed on his head. Let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of the one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" And the king said to Haman, "Well, hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you've suggested, and do so, for Mordecai is the word that came out of the king's mouth, the Jew who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone to all that you said." So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square. Now, how humbling would this be? Parading him down through the square on his horse and robe and all Mordecai, and proclaim before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate. But notice, Haman hurried to his house, mourning and his head covered. Haman had to be beside himself. This was almost the ultimate humiliation. He had to parade Mordecai around the capital city in such a way that he himself wanted to be paraded. Well, once again, as the old saying goes, don't ever get too big for your britches. Chapter 7 then brings us back to the banquet prepared by Esther for Ahasuerus and Haman. Chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day at the banquet of the wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your position or petition?" And Queen Esther, "What is it?" "It shall be granted you." "And what is your request?" "Up to half of the kingdom it shall be done." And Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Well, who is this person? Where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "Well, the adversary, the enemy, is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Talk about everything being turned upside down on him in an instant. Imagine how you would feel if you were in Haman's shoes right then and there. The planned genocide that had been orchestrated by Haman, it appeared, would not occur. I would imagine that Haman found it rather hard to swallow any more food at that particular time at this particular feast. Then the king became quite angry. He left the table, went into the palace garden, upon which time Haman tried one last-ditch effort to save his life. And he turned to Esther looking for mercy, as he was sure he wouldn't receive it from Ahasuerus at this point. The problem is that was not proper etiquette to stay in the room alone with the queen or with a lady. He should have left the room when the king did. Verse 8. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. And the king then said, "Will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house?" As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. I'll read to you from Tyndale's Old Testament commentary regarding this verse, because I feel it's helpful. Quote, "Etiquette with regard to the harem was so strict that it would have been difficult for Haman to converse with the queen without causing offense. Had he not been so desperate, he would not, no doubt, have left with the king as to avoid any possible misinterpretation of his remaining behind with the queen. In approaching her, as she continued to recline on her couch, as was customary at Persian feasts, Haman was going too far. By falling on the couch, he set the seal on his execution. Even had she wished to help, there was nothing Esther could have done to save him. The king was outraged. They covered Haman's face, implies the presence of retainers at hand to carry out the king's intentions. Though the practice of covering the heads of condemned prisoners by the Persians in ancient times is otherwise unattested, it was the custom among the Greeks and Romans." Continuing now, verse 9, chapter 7, how Harboni, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." So the gallows that Haman made, Haman would die on. So they hanged Haman. The gallows had been prepared for Mordecai. And the king's wrath subsided. So as is the case so many times throughout the Bible, God not only provided protection for those that turned to him, he removed the threat entirely by removing Haman. So just as so many of our mothers have great strength, we see the strength that Esther had in this story. She understood where to turn. It is my hope that each woman, mother or otherwise, in here knows where to turn as well. So long as that's the case, no matter what the leadership in our country does, God will take care of you. Mothers, teach your children what God shows us in his word, as that is one of the most important tasks that God has given you. We may be living in a country that is trying to tell us the education system should have the authority to teach our children that they should what they feel they should be taught. But God expects mothers and fathers to be the primary teachers and the Word of God, the primary textbook. In chapter 8, we find that Esther is given Haman's home and Mordecai is given the signet ring that was once given to Haman. Ahasuerus tells Esther and Mordecai to write a decree reversing what Haman wrote. And so a letter was sent to all 127 provinces. I won't go into, because I'm running out of time here, all of that. But you can read verses 9 and chapter 8 all the way through chapter 9, verse 5. The story goes on to tell about Haman's 10 sons being killed and hanged. And this all took place on the 13th day of the 12th month, which followed by a feast on the 14th day, according to verse 17 of chapter 9. As you read further in the chapter, you find that Esther, along with Mordecai, are given prominent position in Jewish history. They exhibited loyalty to one another. They exhibited courage. They were loyal in going to God. For those things, God rewarded them. I trust you feel as I do that we have much to thank our mothers for. And for those whose mother is still alive, I do hope that you do that tomorrow. For those whose mother may no longer be alive, I do hope you give thanks to God for what he gave you through your mother. And I hope that your experience was that you had a mother that loved you very much. As Esther turned to God for help, we too need to always turn to God. Mothers, please follow God. Society around us is not well. The only path that makes any sense is to follow what God teaches. So to go back to the question I posed at the beginning of the sermon today, how would you handle yourself if you were told you could no longer keep the belief you hold or you'd be killed? Esther's story is one that shows you and me where to turn. Let's all be sure to follow Esther's example of going to God. It'll be a great benefit. Let's ask for courage, and let's show courage. This will please God. It'll be a great benefit to your physical family and ultimately to our spiritual family. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms in this room.